So there's only a few more weeks left of the retreat, and it's good to bring that to mind and recognize that this is an opportune time to really derive a benefit from this practice that we have, the way of training that the Buddha laid down is completely available to us, and the whole, it's just like the story of the Buddha after his enlightenment going to teach the five ascetics in Sarnath, and he stopped by another wanderer of some other persuasion, of some sort or another. And part of their exchange, one of the things that the Buddha says is that the doors of the deathless are open. It's good to recognize that is, you know, with the teaching that the Buddha has, the insight that the Buddha has, and then the practice and way of training that he laid down, is that it's opening the doors of the deathless to any one who is willing to practice and put forth effort. As we you think of, well, what is it that opens the doors to the deathless? What is it that closes the doors to the deathless? And thinking of the metaphor, or the image of doors, and then it's sort of the doors of the senses. So what we, you know, when we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and use the intellect in ways that are in line with the Dhamma, in line with truth, then they, right there is the doors of the deathless are open. When we use the eye, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, those doors of the senses in ways that are bound up with desire and ignorance. And it's bound by ignorance and obstructed by instructed by desire. Bound by ignorance, obstructed by desire. It's just so, and it's with those acts of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and using the mind in this moment that the doors of the deathless sort of slam shut, and we're left kind of looking up at these closed doors. Deranged beings of samsara milling around us, and of course we being one of them. I think of the image that Ajahn Sujito drew of the in his book of the Dawn of the Dhamma, and the image that he drew of this crazed monkey Absolute look, the look is absolutely demented, demonic even. He said he drew that in his in his early years, very early years of practice, and as this sort of drawing what his own mind looked like appeared to him, his mind running around, crazed and completely out of control. And that's, sometimes it's not to that extreme, but certainly it can be very, very subtle. But still, it's that not waking up in the present moment as we experience these senses. How are we looking at things? How are we hearing? What are we doing when we're inhabiting the world and the body and our minds? How are we relating to them? That's what, for our practice, there's emphasis on sense restraint, there's emphasis on the precepts, there's emphasis on the developing of the meditation and investigations of wisdom. But how are we actually recognizing or dealing with our basic senses? And are we attending? Are we watching? Are we really trying to see clearly what we're doing? So often what the feeling is it's as if suffering is happening to us. Somehow we're being suffering is impacting us. And we don't really recognize that we're actually we're the protagonists. We're the ones who are creating the suffering. We're the ones who are agreeing to the suffering. We're accepting it. We're completely complicit in this whole process of suffering, and we oftentimes just don't recognize that. So then, what that means is that we just keep moving from one suffering moment to the next. And then, grumble and complain and blame it on others and blame it on the world, blame it on whoever's handy or whatever's handy. So long as we don't have to think that it's to do with us at all. It's like Ajahn Chah using the image of the monk who comes to the evening chanting and kind of smells here. And he gets up and goes to the teacher's dwelling place, goes to Ajahn Chah's kuti, sits down there and smells here, goes back to his own kuti and smells here. Sort of everything smells outside. And he doesn't realize that he's got dog shit in his yam and he's carrying this crap in his monk's bag. And it stinks wherever he goes. And but it's always blamed on something else, the situation, the place, everything outside. It isn't as if it's to do with us. So how are we responding to the senses? What is it? It's like that image that Ajahn Chah uses, and I bring it up a lot because it's very important to make the distinction Ajahn Chah is saying, like, when sound coming to bother me. How do you meditate when sounds come to bother you? And Ajahn Chah says, that's not the right perspective. It isn't that some sounds come to bother you. You're going out and bothering the sounds. The sounds are just sounds. And we go out and bother the sounds. We go and make judgments on them. We like dislike them. We have aversion towards them. We get wound in there, up in there, enticing quality. But we don't see it as just sound. So we bother the sounds. And the same with all the senses. It's through our own particular judgments or particular perspectives that we relate to it in a way that creates problems, creates suffering. To recognize that, in each moment, in each sense experience, we have the opportunity to recognize that's a sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, whatever. And then there's the quality of knowing. The knowing of the sense experience and the knowing of the knower. And when we attend to things in that way, start to separate those out, and you start recognizing where you start layering the quality of suffering, how we perceive things, how we label things. The process of perception is, on a certain level, we say as complex human beings, where we've developed certain capacities that are sort of within the mind and within the body, that are useful, necessary for our survival. And we take a basic sense in contact, and we experience either the pleasant or the unpleasant or neutral, and then we have a memory or perception of its importance, its unimportance, its emotional tone of its kind of in a hierarchy of experience. Is it something to avoid? Is it something to go towards? Is it friendly? Is it an enemy? And and it's necessary, because if we had to sort of figure that all out anew all the time, the world would be very overwhelming. Human life would be, it'd be unbearable. But then, because we build up those habits and conditioning over time, bound by ignorance, obstructed by craving, then we there's a whole backlog of associations that keep us bound and keep us suffering, keep us seeking out the things that are detrimental to our well-being, and sort of maintain a level of confusion. So that as we practice and cultivate, we need to be developing a calmness of mind, a clarity of heart, a stillness within the mind that is able to look at things a bit more clearly and really see, well, what is actually beneficial? What is it that is just a habit? What is it that is creating suffering? What is it? How are we building up in our reactions to things just something which is creates extra baggage that makes us suffer more? And are we willing to let go of it? Because it isn't just sort of analyzing and documenting the myriad ways that we suffer. It's also it's in order to see it clearly enough that we're willing to let go of it. So some of the things are in terms of how we perceive things, the perceptions that we have. Some of it's really deeply ingrained. And it's important to sort of question it. Really, how valid is that? What is it? Is it really that way? Can it be seen in another way? And it doesn't necessarily mean that even changes the perception, but it's how we hold it. So you say, maybe there's other ways. And so one of the things that comes to mind is Remember, going up to visit Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho. The first time that Ajahn Sumedho came back to visit Thailand after being in England for some time, he had a group of lay people with him, and they'd been staying up at Tham Sang Phet, and Ajahn Chah, I think, I actually went with Ajahn Chah. Was with him. Because we arrived and it was at meal time, and then started to bring the food forward and brought a couple kettles up and imagine Cha sort of said, "What's that stink?" And then Ajahn Tun, the abbot of Tham Sang Phet, he says, "Oh, it's those Phurungs. They make this tea with a dog fart vine." In northeastern dialect, cinnamon is called a dog fart vine. It's not considered very very wonderfully fragrant. It's considered as, you know, Ajahn Chah, and then it was, oh, it's Ajahn Chah, then Ajahn Chah. So it's just those strange Phurungs that use these weird things, concoctions. to perception, you know, Ajahn Chah, and he actually took some and drank it, there's a habitual perception that we have. And then, you know, to actually question that, I say, well, you know, how do we arrive at that? Where does that come from? You know, it's the same. It's sort of on a certain level. There is a smell, and then culturally, one culture says, "Oh, that's really fragrant and delicious." Another culture sort of says, "Oh, it really stinks. That's really awful." Or for the, you know, for us as Westerners, there's a condiment that they use in the northeast of Thailand that they make from fermented fish, and it's just for Westerners, it just is so overwhelmingly unpleasant. And then for the northeasterners, just starting to really get good, you know. So that these are learned responses. And if we hold to a particular, just sort of say, well, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly how we perceive it, consider it. And so actually and that's not normally how when I experience something that I don't like, then it's obvious to me that the whole world doesn't like that. Why would it not be that way? When I like something, why shouldn't everybody else like it? When I think something is right, then why shouldn't it? Shouldn't that's why shouldn't everybody, the whole world, think that that is right? That's exactly how it should be. But those are just that. It's just perception. You know. So how we relate to the world, relate to our senses. What is it that, and it's not necessarily, but you know, what is fragrant, what is smelly, what is delicious, what is ghastly. It's sort of, you know, what is it that we create suffering around? Because then we take those basic impressions, and then we have desire either to gain, to get, to keep, to maintain, or to destroy, annihilate, push away, be averse to. And we're being pushed and pulled by that all the time. And that's the sort of the core of the kind of the ignorance or the delusion that we live by, is that what we experience is always true, because it's what I experience and what I think is right and true and valid. And we don't apply mindfulness, we don't apply awareness, we don't attend to the experience and then the reaction as phases of momentary sensory contact and progression. So that's the duty of us as meditators, is start to be very much more clear and precise in what is the experience and what's the reaction, and what use is that reaction serving, and how clear is that experience of what we've of the sense experience, and are we seeing it in terms of Dhamma, or are we seeing and experiencing it in terms of our desire and ignorance, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. So that's to keep coming back to that point, so that we can start to untangle the way that we create suffering, rather than, you know, it's as if, you know, we get this neatly wrapped package of suffering and then we just accept it. And start recognizing, you know, how it's us who are wrapping up our sense experience and sort of creating the whole package of suffering that we grumble and complain about, feel oppressed by. And how do we, you know, same thing in terms of, you know, how do we perceive ourselves, and how useful are the perceptions that we have? You know, we perceive ourselves in certain ways. And how do we, you know, how valid is that? And what function is it performing? Obviously, we have to have some kind of self-image or self-perception. I mean, there is a... I mean, the Buddha never said that self was a non-existent thing. He just said that it doesn't have the, say, a nature of stability or permanence or and isn't a useful concept to be clinging to. But we perceive ourselves as competent, or we conceive ourselves as knowing this or that, having, or perceive ourselves as incompetent, perceive ourselves as weak in some way. You know, we carry those images around. And there's a constructed image out of, very select. It's selecting things from our experience. That is only a small part of the spectrum. And it rarely, we don't hold it in its sort of true light, where we take the, we pick and choose the things that fit with that particular perception, and then create the image of ourselves from that. And it's important to really recognize that that of all the variety of things that we sort of experience, or how we go about our lives, and those are the things that the mind focuses on. So Ajahn Brahma Wangso tells a story about himself in early days of the building of the Perth Monastery, and in those days they did pretty much all the work themselves, because just lack of funds not having the means to hire people. And there in Western Australia, the main form of construction is bricklaying. Bricks they use. That's the sort of cheapest, strongest building material. You learn to lay bricks doing this wall, being very careful, learning the techniques and doing the wall, and starting to get pretty good at it, and finish this wall, and then realize that he'd made a mess of a couple bricks, and it really upset of this. He wanted to knock the wall down and start over again. And Ajahn Chakra wouldn't allow it. And he said, "Waste of good materials. And that just every time he walked past that wall, he'd sort of see these two bricks. And if people came to visit the monastery, and sort of showing them things, and that's what he'd see. But then, you know, over time, he realized that actually nobody else noticed those two or three bricks that were out of not nicely placed. And then somebody actually, one day he sort of brought it up, and and somebody saying, "Wow, this is a really nice job that you've done." And so, "Well, yeah, except there's this mistake there." And they said, "Oh, that's nothing. Everything else looks really good. You don't really notice. Nobody notices that." And it finally sunk in that, there's this whole wall, and then the mind is just focusing on the flaw, the one little flaw, the one thing. And that's what we do all the time. Whether it's a flaw or whether it's a particular sort of strength. I mean, it goes both ways in the sense of either way. You know, we either inflate or deflate the experience to fit into a particular perception. And, we don't really see things clearly. You don't see the whole picture. So that's what our Dhamma practice should be doing, is sort of really recognizing the bigger picture of things, seeing the reality of the situations. And drawing attention back to the Dhamma. And so that sense of in the actual sense experience, for there just to be the sense, the cognized. See what we, rather than in the scene, then creating a whole realm of desire or frustration out of it. What we hear, creating a whole worlds of complication and proliferation. So this is a sense experience that has a particular tone to it. Makes an impression, and to let it arise and cease right there, seeing it as in as an impermanent phenomena, as a phenomena, as a Dhamma, as opposed to a whole story. This is a Dhamma that arises and ceases. This is another Dhamma that arises and ceases. And that doesn't, one isn't trying to make oneself into a kind of a neutral, non-feeling, bland blob of jelly, but whatever, whatever reaction is there is also part of the realm of Dhamma that arises and ceases, and not to, either create a big story, a big problem, either inflating it or deflating it out of proportion. Recognizing this is, well, it's a vehicle, whatever we experience is actually a vehicle for our seeing clearly, our experiencing things in their true nature. And then it's a blessing. Then it's something that is something that illumines the heart. When we're either, trying to squeeze pleasure and gratification out of experience, it becomes so burdensome. Trying to be entertained, trying to be happy. In such a miserable existence, trying to be happy all the time. it's such a chore that people set for themselves, trying to make themselves happy. Or that sense of just confusion and complication that we create of the perception of me and myself, my problems, my personal unique sort of qualities that need to be kind of massaged and pandered to all the time. Just to allow experience to arise and cease without that burden of me. And it's that really freeing. Bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. See how this trying to recognize more clearly, how we build that up, how we get bound and entangled. And constructing a huge, complicated theory around that, but really coming back to those fundamental sense impressions, the sense doors, and realize, they say that the doors are either, say, doorways into entanglement, or, say, the door to the deathless can be opened by seeing things in their true nature, seeing things in their reality, understanding things as they are, and then those refrains of that knowledge and vision of the way things are, is not some sort of philosophical treatise that the Buddha lays down for us, but is a direct result of the peaceful mind that is clear and still, and not layered over with the complications of our sort of I, me, and mine. And sort of either the desire mind or kind of delusion, mind of delusion. So to be cutting through that by just returning to this This is a sight, this is a sound, this is a smell, this is a taste, this is a touch. This is a mental phenomena. You know, when we start to attend to things, you know, and the sights and sounds are a bit easier to sort of isolate. And it's when it's brought into the mind, then it gets a bit more complicated. So it's important to just keep attending to, okay, this is, that's the reaction, that's the mind moving, that's the extra thought that is added to that. But it's really helpful to start to take a sense door and to attend to it and see, well, what's the problem here? What is it that is obstructing my peace of mind, my clarity, other than the obstructions I'm creating myself? And that was something I personally was really fortunate to get an insight into that in the very early, actually my first meditation retreat, because it was the retreat was held at a, or a, it wasn't held, I mean it was at a monastery, and then I went in and doing a solitary retreat for 30 days. And is in the city. And you know, like on one side of the monastery, Chiang Mai, which is it's quite a big city, and it was an old monastery, so it was built up all around, and one side of the monastery was kind of woodworkers, and there's a lot of teak in the north, so there's also woodworkers. So you can hear the sort of tunk, 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 the people working wood all the day. And then sort of the other side of the monastery were silver workers, and ching, 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 this constant. And then that's on, and then on the room that I was in, and then that came. There was all just a road and all the houses, and everybody plays loud music all the time, day and night. And I thought I was going crazy at first. It's all this noise. And then the teacher says, no, it's just, I mean, noise is you know what you add to it. All there is sound and hearing. And start to attend to that. And it was really interesting because I kept really investigating and watching it, and then it really did. It was okay. It just where the mind settled. And there was the sound, and there was the hearing, and then there was the mind that was completely still. It was really, and then you could either attend to or recognize that there was, you recognize, oh, there's the sound. And there's the hearing. And there's the mind that's completely still. And then you could either attend to the mind that's completely still, or attend to the recognize the sound without being moved by it. And it's also, I mean, and that you know, it's easy to forget that experience, but it's very important to see it, so that you can keep returning. Because again, you know, ignorance and delusion are so ingrained that we get swept up. But to really investigate that, to see it and recognize those are very different parts of the process. And the doors to the deathless are open. And if we want to choose to make sort of kind of the world a cacophonous, noisy, impinging experience, yeah, you can do that. One can make it into something quite miserable. But it's not necessary. Bringing the attention back to the Dhamma and realizing that there is this opportunity to not create suffering. You don't have to sort of go out and sort of slay the dragon of suffering. You just don't create it, don't make it, don't buy into it. It doesn't have to be there. And so the point of entry is just in these very basic, fundamental sense contact. And to be returning to that. And obviously that's why we sit meditation, why we do all the practice of mindfulness, is that we can gain a momentum of attending skillfully, applying mindfulness in a skillful way, so that we can see things clearly. Particularly the meditation, letting the mind really settle, giving the mind the opportunity to become still. And that's what that direct sort of link of say with samadhi as a condition. What arises in is the knowledge and vision of the way things are. To support oneself in turning attention to the peacefulness, stillness, settledness of the mind, so that one can really get a glimpse of what are things as they really are. So offer that for reflection this evening.